So this is our last talk together. And I'd just like to give a brief sort of synopsis of just an overview of what's been on offer for these last few days together. And hopefully there's something there for you to take away with you. The main focus, without question, is on the cultivation of awareness, which actually, in a sense, is a contradiction, because you can't really cultivate awareness. What you can do is the awareness can become more aware of itself. There is no object to cultivate. There certainly isn't anybody who cultivates it. That's actually an important point. And the way that's on offer, the way that this way of nurturing that polishing of awareness is primarily to bring the practice as much as we possibly can from probably where it's been since the beginning, which is more or less in our heads and in our intellect and in that whole development type mentality, to learn to bring that into the body, bring that into the awareness, so that we begin to learn to practice out of the body, so that we learn to bring the mind, as it were, into the body and start what Dharma is about is it's a reintegration, it's a reintegrating process, a reintegrating of the split between mind and body. And it's that split that creates the world, it creates duality and creates the samsaric world that we're all caught up in. And this is the way that we begin that integrating process, is by turning our attention into awareness, an awareness we discover is in the body, and to abide in the body, to bring our awareness, to bring our life, and to learn to live our life out of our body more than out of our minds. And to learn very quickly, actually, this is a practice of direct impact. This is like living. This is life in the raw. It's an impact. There's no thought, there's no concepts that we bring up that create that very subtle little space between me and the world, me and my experience, me and that direct impact that we have and so often we wish to avoid. There's nothing to think about, there are no labels and lists to hang on what is a direct experience. Very simple, drinking a cup of tea, which we all do every day. Just in the ordinary everyday, just to open up to that direct experience without distancing ourselves from it, without trying to take hold of it, without trying to run away from it, without trying to manipulate it, without trying to possess it and do things and fiddle as we always do with virtually every experience we have. If we notice ourselves very carefully, closely, we will see we're always in the mode of controlling. And that controlling comes from something that needs to control, and that if it's not in control, becomes very fearful. And we find that we live most of our lives in that mode of basically avoiding fear. And it's a learning to open up to that direct impact, which is very much the major characteristic of this form of practice. It is bereft of all ideas, all systems and methods and avenues and things to cultivate, things to do. It's just being with what is in front of us. And we will discover that if we willingly open and engage in that practice, very soon, that aspect of us that I think so many don't regard as being particularly important or as something that often just gets in the way, which is our emotional experience, something that so many of us seem to think that we have to control and stick away somewhere because it gets in the way, and push it out the way so that we can do our practice. This is if that's a mind that people have got, this couldn't be more contrary to that. This is the complete opposite. What we're doing is actually we're opening up to our emotions and we're putting away all the other stuff. So it's a bit of a revolution. And to really open up to that direct impact. This is living, and our emotions are a part of us. We are our emotions. If we never had emotions, we would be dead. Our emotions come in many different sizes and many different colours, many different intensities, but we are all in a state of emotion, like even now, where we could all, most of us could be very peaceful and quiet, we are still in the state of emotion. So the emotion, we are the emotion, and by turning away from our emotion, we're turning away from ourselves, which is a bit odd, given that Dharma is about learning to understand ourselves and learning about ourselves. So how can we actually really understand ourselves if we're prepared to turn away from ourselves? It's all a bit crazy really, isn't it? And it's really, it's that willingness to turn round, as it were, and to open up to ourselves, open up to our emotional, the emotional impact and the emotional involvement that we have with our life's experiences. And a willingness, rather than to manipulate and to control and to possess and to react. All of these things are called attachment. Rather than go down that familiar road of attachment, we say yes, we open up, we let go, we through awareness, we stop ourselves from going down that familiar road of attachment and to open ourselves to that direct experience and learn to support that emotional reaction that we will invariably get sooner or later. Sometimes a little, maybe sometimes no reaction, sometimes a little, sometimes really quite powerful. And learn to support that power, that energy, that emotion. And what we're doing is that we're actually opening up and we're supporting ourselves. This isn't something that's getting in the way. This is it. This is what we are. And the only way that we're ever going to get to know ourselves is that we have to learn, be prepared to accept ourselves the way that we are. If we're going to play with that and manipulate it and push it away because we don't like what we see, we're going to avoid ourselves. And if we avoid ourselves, we're never going to know ourselves. And if we're never going to know ourselves, that samsaric world that we're bound to will not fall away, will not die, will not go into change. And this is a very direct way of actually dealing with that reality of what Dharma practice is about. Because this is what it's about. It's about getting to know you, getting to know yourself. And to willingly open to those emotional reactions, whatever they may be, is a willingness to open up to yourself. It is a willingness to say yes to yourself. This is the way I am. These are my habits. These are my, all the things that I react to, that so many of the things actually I don't like, but actually are not very good at all, and things that we're not necessarily proud of. But instead of pretending they're not there or trying to do something with them, we just allow them to be without any opinions. Just open and leave them alone, but not to buy into them, not to be carried away and caught up in the usual business. And learn to open to that and learn to accept and learn to carry that reaction, that emotion. Learn to carry it around in your life. Through all the situations, just the mundane everyday, nothing special, just the everyday life that we all lead. Learn to carry that openness towards ourselves. And learn to create that cradle of spaciousness, and this only becomes possible when we bring awareness to that experience, because it's awareness that does the retaining, that does the containing. Awareness is not something that forces. Awareness actually is not something that forces and tries to control, but actually it acts as a It acts as a vessel, as a cradle, that we can actually put things within it. And if, as long as we retain the cradle, then we won't get carried away by the things that are in it. And it gently sits there, not in a sense of force, but it will sit there of itself. Because through that awareness, we don't get caught by it, we don't get carried away by it, we don't lose that cradle of awareness. And this is a very refined state, actually. And this is the state that, this is the, I like to call the environment, the dharmic environment that we create through awareness, through commitment, through a willingness to open up to ourselves, through a willingness to accept ourselves, and to bear with that karmic volition that just keeps turning that wheel of becoming, that paticca samuppada that just spins eternally. And it's a learning to bear with all of those forces. All this is possible with that awareness. And it's through that, and it's through that environment, where that when you look at it, and when you actually pick what's going on, you'll see that you're not actually doing anything. You are just retaining, and you're just living with what's in front of you. Whatever life presents you, with nothing. So we don't go looking for environments and different situations. We just accept it as it comes, and we respond and we engage with life in the most human way that we can. And we learn to carry that world, that sense of self, that sense of me, that what I am. We learn to carry that in an open and free way. That is the dharmic environment. And within that openness and within that containment, we can begin to get to see ourselves and begin to get to know ourselves and begin that very difficult relationship of learning to like ourselves, because most of the time, most of us actually do have issues with ourselves and we have conflict with ourselves, especially us Western people. We have a lot of stuff that we have difficulties with. And we learn to open and embrace and to carry all of that, and learn to allow, as I was given the analogy yesterday of a fire, because that's what it is. These are emotional fires, greed, hatred and delusion. These are fires that burn. Sometimes they're not very powerful, sometimes they're raging fires. And we learn to open and accept that fire, but we don't throw fuel on it. And by just learning to put that environment in place and learning to keep it in place through commitment, by coming back to that awareness, that cradle that will support the fire and will allow you not to throw fuel onto the fire. You'll have that awareness not to go back into that old reactivity. It's that process there of learning to open, to get to know ourselves and learning to make friends with ourselves, that whole dualistic conflict that we all experience begins to lose its power. And as it loses its power, those conflicts that we have with ourselves and with others begin to lose their power, begin to lose their intensity and their destructiveness and the attachment that's all bound up in that. And slowly those two hearts begin to merge, begin to come together, because it's the power that keeps them apart, that creates the duality, that keeps that dualistic world in play. And it's by allowing that fire to go out that the thing begins to merge. And that's the learning to make friends with ourselves. We begin to come back into the whole. And there's a way of looking at that we've got ourselves into such a state with our dualistic world, without continually throwing fuel on the fire, as we all thought was so amusing yesterday, but in fact this is what we do. We get into such a dualistic state with our experience of life, that we become so fractured and so fragmented. It's like we just explode into bits. There are bits here and there are bits there. There's this going on and that going on. And there's just this whole raft of dualistic experiences that we have. And it's the human heart that's actually being fragmented, that's being exploded. It's, again, we're now going beyond theory, we're actually coming into the heart of the matter, which is the real me, the real heart, is that we are a being of fragmentations, that heart seems to be fragmented into bits. And a way of describing this practice through awareness is like awareness surrounds all of those fragmentations. It's like it puts its arms, the Dharma puts its arms around all of that, so that each of those fragmentations begins to lose its power and begins to come back to the centre, to come back where it belongs, where it wants to belong. And it's really nothing more than a practice of healing a broken heart, of mending a broken heart. That's all this is. That's all we're doing, is mending our broken heart. So if you want to write a song about that, please. But this is what it is. We are in that turmoil with ourselves, with other people, and somehow we're so disturbed by that we can actually see things that we have with ourselves, and then we can see things that we have with other people, and then we can start to go out there and blame other people for the conflict and for the messes that we can get ourselves into, and we become so deluded that we actually think that it's actually to do with the people out there rather than it has to do with me, so we can negate our responsibilities and it's all out there and I'm okay and it's all your fault. Well, actually, when you really begin to open up and begin to enter that path of wisdom, you actually see that your relationship with the world, with people and with the world outside, is actually a mirror of the relationship with yourself, because self and other are one. There is actually no space, and this is part of the delusion that we get into, that we're convinced that it's not my fault, nothing to do with me. And this is all part of the process. We become so divorced from ourselves that we actually put something way out there on the other side of the universe. That's how we can get so caught by all of this. And learning to create that cradle of openness through awareness, we begin to see that this world that we create and how we've created it and how we've been fueling it all of the time, and it just gets worse. It doesn't get better. And it's learning to declutch, to leave it alone, to declutch. Don't jump on the engine. Leave the engine alone, but just declutch from it, from its volition, and just leave the thing alone. And it's in that leaving alone that we begin to understand we're engaging upon something here that's been inconceivable to us, and it's never been taught us. And we need to create that familiarity of coming back into that awareness, into that openness, and to bring that world of ours, to put it in front of us, so that we can start that process of making friends. And that friendship, when it matures, will actually turn to love. Not the love that most of us know, but something quite tremendous, because it becomes selfless. And when it's selfless, when it's truly selfless, it's limitless. And it embraces everybody. And it embraces all of life. And this is a taste of our true nature, how we really are, what amazing creatures we really are. But we've allowed ourselves to get caught up in a horrible little mess, really. But actually, you know, it has its good points, and you know, life can actually be quite, it can be very good at times. It can be very joyful and very positive, and you know, let's not rubbish the whole thing. But it does have an underlying characteristic, is that it is basically unsatisfactory, and that's what Buddhists believe. And when it's unsatisfactory, it will never quite give us that fulfillment that we all fundamentally are looking for. There's always something not quite right, and we all know that things change, and somehow that just takes the edge off of so many of, you know, so much of the wonder that we can experience in life, that it is transitory. And it's that process of learning to open and learning to actually discover what's going on, and learn to that incredibly subtle dharmic way of making friends. It's so simple, and yet we discover when we try to put that simplicity into effect, it turns out to be very difficult. It's very difficult because we're just racked with habits and conditioning, and we fall over and over. By creating this environment, we can learn slowly to send all of that stuff into change. It goes into change of itself, primarily. And it does become very, very difficult, very burdensome. We all know we wouldn't be here today if it was easy. We come here because we're looking for support and guidance. Of course we are. This is what Buddhism is about. This is why we're here. And I also touched on, yesterday I believe, about learning to share that burden, about learning to open up and sharing that enormous difficulty that we have just learning to be with ourselves. How incredibly difficult that is. To begin to learn to share that weight, and begin to open up, to go beyond that thing that thinks it's the centre of the universe and it's the be all of the end all, and there isn't anything else beyond me. To learn to open up to that, and to, in a sense, to break through that barrier, and we break through that barrier with awareness, and begin to get little tasters, if we don't already have them, and something beyond that sad, piddly little thing, to get a taste of something that's, well, it's just so vast, and to discover more that actually, that it isn't necessarily out there, as we often like to think, and very often people try to tell us that it's out there, but to discover that actually that it is actually, we are a part of that, we are a part of something far greater, and learn to develop a relationship skillfully in a way that we've never developed relationships, a parallel relationship with anything else in our life, and a learning to develop that relationship, which has that basic characteristic of humility. We don't have humility in our normal life. We have humility in our life, we get walked on. So we learn to look after ourselves. But here we turn the whole thing on its head, and we learn to develop that humility with that which is beyond me. And unless we do develop that humility, we will never make contact with it. It will never open itself and show itself. Because without humility, we're in a state of self. And when we're in a state of self, we're blind. Simple. And to learn to open in a skillful way, and learn this great difficulty, what is so incredibly simple, and yet is so incredibly difficult. To learn to share that with that which isn't me, learn to hand it. And if we do it skillfully, if we do it correctly, that which isn't me will be, it aches to help us. It aches. And it will open and take that burden off of you and lift it. And lift it so that you begin to get even more spaciousness, you begin to go beyond the bounds of that self and that incredible, I've got to do something about this, so that it becomes even more of a burden and even more difficult. Learn to give it away. with that development of humility, and that has to be genuine. And I think that sort of rounds the picture off, in that that's really the message. I mean, you know, we can talk on and develop it more, but I believe this is the framework which, if we can open up to and learn to take on board, you know, that framework, that openness, that awareness, is not an object, is not a thing. And if we learn to cultivate it in the correct way, it will actually embrace everything. It actually, because it's not an object in itself, it is incapable of embracing anything that you may come up with, anything in your life. All Buddhist practices it will embrace, because it's not an object. It will not. It is not limited. It doesn't have limitations. It doesn't go so far and then stop and then bump into other things. It is emptiness. This is shunyata. And shunyata is not how many people believe, that it's some sort of a nothingness, sort of dead, lifeless, cold nothingness thing that people often interpret that word shunyata. There is no parallel in the English language that can touch that word shunyata, not even get within anywhere near it. And we really need to turn away from this need to translate it, to understand it. Forget all the translations and actually get to become intimate. What is a word, of course, is a concept, but learn to open up to that true meaning of what shunyata means. And shunyata, you know, what words can you use? Because it's not an object. You can't, it's not a thing that you can describe. But one thing for sure, it is not this empty nothingness that so many of us like to think that it is. The one word that best describes it, I would say, the one word that really matters to all of us, is that shunyata is love. And love isn't something that's dead. It is love that is selfless, that it doesn't have a centre, it doesn't have a motivation, it doesn't have an ulterior motive for being what it is. It embraces the whole of life. All of us live out of that love. All of life. And I mean also the inanimate things as well as the animate. This is the mystery. Everything is love. And through the cultivation, the heartfelt cultivation of this practice, because Dharma is about the heart. It isn't about the head. And it's a learning to bring the heart through the body. The heart is in the body. The learning to bring the heart into the practice will, quicker than anything, allow us to open up to shunyata, to love that supports all of life, that wants to help, that wants to support us and guide us with wisdom that we could not even begin to imagine. With wisdom that we can awaken to, if we allow ourselves to awaken. And to try and bring the whole of that feeling into the practice, and to keep coming back to it, because, you know, the dark side, the devil, the dark side, Darth Vader will be coming all the time to you don't want to bother with all that. This is much better. It's a learning not to fall into that trap, and a learning to come back over and over and over again into that spaciousness, into that awareness, into that shunyata. This is the Dharma, this is reality, this is the eternal law that we all live out of. And we can taste it very easily if we just learn to be quiet. It's not something that's on the other side of the universe. We are living out of it, literally we are living out of it, and without it we would not be here. And the learning to to be still and to be quiet with that spaciousness, we begin to get tastes, we begin to get a real inkling, a real flavour of what our true nature really is. And it's something that we can come back to and nurture more and more, so that we slowly we let go of this fellow that's taken us out of the Garden of Eden. And more, learn to let that fellow go. Learn to let the fire burn itself out. Just let it burn itself out in that shunyata. Allow it to just burn itself out. We need to come back over and over and over again, because we get taken away from that. But just try to, whatever you're going to do when you leave here, if you take that, I can absolutely guarantee you, if you've got a Dharma practice and you're more inclined to another way, and this way you don't feel is really what you want to pursue, this will never ever give you any trouble. It cannot give you trouble. It will never get in the way. It will never confuse you. It will never create any conflict. If there's any of those things are experienced by any of you, please look at your practice. Because if you put this in place, shunyata does not conflict. It cannot conflict. It is not an object, and it cannot create problems. It's impossible. So, if you wish to pursue other paths that you find are very useful for you, that help you a lot more, then that's fine. You can take this cradle with you, and you can put your practice, and it will bring life and richness to whatever you're doing, and it will bring you very close to your true nature, your original nature, to the Buddha. We have a few minutes if anybody got any wild objections to what I've just said.
You talked about working with your body, looking at your habits in daily life. I got the impression that you made a distinction between the example of you giving up smoking, which you said was willpower and was a worldly challenge. It had nothing to do with the Dharma.
It's a worldly example.
Yeah.
Because I'm doing something. I don't want to be like that. I want to be like this. I've changed. But that's not Dharma change.
Yeah.
I've just changed my jump. You know, I had a different jump on a couple of days ago. So I changed. Wow, isn't this practice easy, eh? That's a worldly change. That doesn't count.
The difference between that and your friend getting distracted by ants on the way to the bus.
Uh-huh.
And so you're saying we should pick and choose. There's some habits we should look at and bring our attention to, and some that we should...
When we become aware of ourselves, we become aware of all of our habits, and we will quite naturally look at the ones, if we're really keen on doing this, we'll look at the ones that we have that really do get in the way, that really do stop us, that really just block the path. We will quite naturally give those a lot more attention, because you look at it, and maybe for the first time you look at it, well, that's pretty dumb actually, what do I do that for? You know, that's really unskillful, that's really stupid. And before we were so blinded by whatever it may be that we never even crossed our mind to question it. I mean, that's part of the process. And we will naturally refine our life in many ways. That's a part of the skillful means. I mean, that's not like the ultimate change, as it were. But it's all that skillful means of which Buddhism is what Buddhism is. If we put those skillful means in place, i.e. I won't do whatever I've been doing all these years anymore, I'll just actually have a bit of willpower, if you like, to say no, I'm not doing that anymore. That's a help, and we have lots of guidelines in Buddhism. We have the whole ethical framework there's a very, very skillful way of aligning ourselves with reality, because these are all the ethical standards that are presented to us are all aspects of the liberated human heart. It's our true humanness that we all would like to be, and in a sense, I always like to think that, you know, the ethical path, as it were, is a way of practicing to be enlightened. Because we're actually nurturing the natural human qualities, the qualities of the unfettered human heart. I mean, the human heart isn't dead; it is the true human being that has incredible qualities, qualities for good. That when the devil's no longer there, it has limitless ability in doing good. And so the ethical dimension is a way of nurturing. It's a skillful way to do it, but this is not the thing in the end. This is not what it is, and that's a lot of people get stuck by that, and they think it's about being a good person, and that's all that matters. And from my experience of good people, is that they tend to be a little bit of a pain, actually. But there you go. That's only my experience. But it's, you know, we mustn't, therefore, because of that, we mustn't, you know, eject the whole ethical side. Yeah. It's a skillful, it's a way of training, of a way of learning to put that environment into place. We sort of help it along, as it were. We do sensible things. And we know this, as adults, generally. And then we turn to Buddhism, and it's got it all there. It tells us. It says, look, and Buddhism never says you must do this and you must do that. He says, look, you know, this is a good idea, this is something to aspire to, and if you don't want to do it, fair enough. Nobody will ever say that you have to do it. Mm. It's up to you, you've got that free will. That's what's wonderful about this religion, is that there's no commandments. But if you're not prepared to follow what's on offer, you're not going to aspire to what brings you there in the first place for. So, you know. But yeah, we are involved with life, and things are coming and going. We got to engage with it and be sensible. But there's a bigger picture behind that that actually embraces all of those. That actually embraces ethics, and actually says that, you know, ethics is just another object in that spaciousness. And ultimately, those objects in that spaciousness are not the real thing. They're all upayas.
So rather than us kind of getting involved and saying, these are the important habits and these are what I should change to become a good Buddhist, we should just get on with our practice and then certain habits.
It is a dodgy path, because you could end up really, really wanting to be a good Buddhist and do all the right things and say all the right things, you know, and sit there and they never... that's not very Buddhist, is it? Call yourself a Buddhist, do you? Ooh, you raised your voice. Ooh. We can get stuck. We can get stuck very easily. You know, we get stuck in the finger that's pointing to the moon. We think the finger is the moon, as the Zen, famous Zen expression, very insightfully points to, that it's what we are, but because we are so conditioned, we do take the finger that points to the moon as being the moon. And we have to be very careful.
Can I ask something related to that? My question is about the difference between working to create the conditions for practice, the practice of non-doing, and then just the non-doing. And you've actually put emphasis on both things, like over the days, that to be careful to provide the conditions you need to support your practice, but actually don't actually try and put the fire out, as it were. And during the course of the retreat, you talk about part of setting up the conditions for practice is to recognize what's going on in your mental state and use other practices that will help you, like mindfulness of breathing or metta, for example. I suppose what I want to do is try to bring a kind of harmony between your teaching and my teaching, because I lead a lot of beginners retreats here, and what I provide for people is we provide a peaceful shrine in the country and a regular program and staged practices like mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana and just sitting practice, where there's a beginning and an end and there's just space to be aware in. And I kind of see the conditions, including the other practices like mindfulness and metta, kind of supporting that practice of just being aware. And I think that's something that you've helped to clarify this week, is that that practice of just sitting and being aware is in the centre, and everything else is just supporting that. But it's like, it's what Kim was saying, it's like, if you look at your mind and ask yourself, well, what do I need to put in place to support my practice? There's a bit of ill will there, so maybe I need to do some metta, there's a bit of restlessness there, maybe I do need to do some mindfulness of breathing. And actually, it looks like you have to be quite careful not to end up being overly kind of particular and overly kind of judgmental about what you need to do, what you need to put into place. But if you spend all your time trying to kind of fiddle around and putting things into place, you never get around to doing the bit in the middle.
And who's the one who's putting all the bits in place in the first place? You see, there's the dangers in all of this.
Yeah.
I'm not criticising any other practices. I'm just saying that this particular one actually doesn't go down that road. It just opens and goes to that basic nature that we all live out of.
Mm.
That what's in the middle, what sits within that, is that thing called Buddhism with all of its skillful means. And that and these are perfectly bona fide ways of focusing on and of developing, if that's what, you know, these are authentic Buddhist practices. But I believe all of those are a means to an end. They are not the end in themselves, and that's the big danger that we fall into.
Mm.
We get attached to that, and it's about this. This is the finger. We get attached to the finger, and that's the big danger, because that's what we do. That's our makeup. That's how we are as conditioned beings. We attach to objects, and the objects become the real thing.
Mm.
What this is doing is just it's sweeping everything away. Without compromise, even the deepest Buddhist wisdom is ignorance. We don't want any of it. We just want that natural openness that we all live out of. You can go to that extreme, if you call that an extreme. It's like, to me, this is base one. This is it. Or you can employ these different skill forms, including we're just talking about ethics. I mean, that's the way that people can use, as well as metta and you know, how many are there? I mean, how many are in this movement? Never mind what's beyond, through all the other traditions. I mean, Tibetans have got countless different things, but they all ultimately come back to that. They all lead back to that one emptiness. And it's when we aspire to that emptiness and stay in that emptiness where we truly are not attached, we truly do not get caught up in any objects, when we let all of those go. You know, people imagine that when people awaken, when they return to their true nature, they're these incredible wise beings. They've got so much wisdom and so much knowledge that it's just so perfected and so big and mature that it just like forces its way into into awakening. This is what people imagine, that they're just this being that's just so incredibly wise. Actually, I'll tell you the truth there. Nothing could be further from the truth. Because when that time comes, when you are truly standing at the door, if you like, or the gate of returning to your original nature, you are like a baby. You've gone round the universe. You've become wise. You've got so much knowledge and understanding of the whole of this makeup of the self and the incredible, unbelievable structure that it is. You've gone through all of that. You've unpicked the whole thing. You've taken a spanner and you've unbolted the whole thing, and it's all in front of you. And say, wow, look at it. All of that has to go. You have no baggage at all, not even the baggage of wisdom. You've got nothing. We're carrying the bags of ignorance. There comes a time when you carry the bags of wisdom. But even those bags of wisdom have got to go. And you become just like a baby. And when you are truly, truly like a baby, when you are not attached to anything at all, that's when the gate will open. And not many people know that. This is what we imagine. We've got to become a really wise being. I've got to know all about the Dharma, and I've got to, you see, it's all bits and pieces, it's all things, it's objects, it's on and on and on and on. And it's just like being in the world. You just end up with loads of knowledge. I am a wise person. I know the meaning of life and all that sort of stuff. The Dharma's not interested in any of that. He couldn't care less whether you know the meaning of life or not. It's not the slightest bit interested. It wants you to be. It's what in Buddhism they call purity. That purity, that innocence, the innocence of a baby. When you aspire to that innocence, and you can't force it, you can't make it. It has to be a natural letting go. It's when we truly let go. As I said before, this whole thing is about learning to be unattached, is learning to let go. So when you reach that stage where all of this stuff that you can't, and you can spend years musing over it, and it's wonderful, you know, wah, wah, wah. So anything that comes to the mind, whatever the deepest wisdom that before has just knocked you sideways because it's just been so brilliant, it just has to come to the mind and fall away. Come to the mind and fall away. Come to the mind. And the mind doesn't stop. The mind, the thinking thing, that phenomenon still carries on, but it all becomes totally transparent and it just rises and passes away, rises and passes away. And there is nothing. There is no wisdom. There is nothing. That's called. That is the middle way. The middle way is that when we truly become unattached, that's the equanimity towards everything that rises, and we are like a baby. And when that baby becomes the true baby of innocence and purity, then it all opens. So, what we do with this practice, from the beginning, we begin to practice being a baby. And we aspire to being a baby. And a baby is something in its true infancy, doesn't know attachment, it lets go. Something comes in, it lets go. And this is what we do in this practice, we just let go. But we find it so difficult that we do employ different means. And this is called Buddhism, that helps us to let go, but it is about letting go. And all I'm saying in this type of practice is we don't bother ourselves and getting attached to other things. We're attached to enough things as they are. Let's just deal with what we've got and develop that commitment to just become more and more open to what we've got and what we are. And that's the nature of this sort of practice. But I say that the nature of that is because of its nature, it will embrace everything else if you so wish to use skillfully and properly. And if that's the route that you wish to go down, then that's absolutely fine. Many, many people want to go down that route. And that's fine. But ultimately, all routes lead to the same gate. There's only one gate. Not 50 different gates, there's one. And they all can start. There's the path is like this. There's only one path. And there are lots of starting points across that path. And you can walk that path and you go. But eventually they all come to. You have to. It's one path and there's one gate. And they all have to meet. And you'll find that, you know, when you do go into these more conceptual practices over the years, you'll find quite naturally how they've all refined. And you don't get caught up in the concepts. Less and less and less and less. And in the end, you do it because you don't really think about it. You don't, you know, get involved with it. It just sort of happens. And that's the refining process. And it happens with mindfulness of breathing. That gets to such a stage where you just sit. You don't bother with putting your attention here and there. You just fall into that stillness. And that actually merges into, if that's the right word, merges into pure awareness. Because they're not two, you see, they've got a slightly different starting point, but they will always come together. And this practice is about, actually, it's like standing at the end of the path. This is what this practice is. We're not bothering about back here with all these bits. We're positioning ourselves up there. And we're letting everything go. But it's not, but it is the path. I don't know if that answered what you were saying, but...
Yes.
I often just wander off. I completely forget whatever the question was, I'm afraid. It's the way I am.
Yeah. I don't answer it, and I especially recognise how if you can say, like, if you practice metta-bhavana, if you practice it in a sort of kind of hands-off kind of way, you're just setting up conditions and then letting whatever happens happen. And not trying to change yourself.
Yeah.
You're just kind of providing a set of conditions for a few minutes and then see what happens.
That's right.
And it just, you know, whatever happens, yeah, happens. And that, it's so easy to get in there and try and sort of smash the illusion or force the method or something. Actually just makes it worse because it just kind of creates more reactions,
yeah,
and the whole thing spins.
That's right. Well, this is the danger, isn't it? This is the danger. Yeah. That we set up things and then we want to control them. Because that's what we do. That's how we are as people. We're always in a state of wanting to control and to make it my way. That's the great danger of giving too much attention to the finger.
I've not found it easy to merge the two either. I have a question there. And it's quite difficult. It's easier to choose either pure awareness or more sort of incremental steps of mindfulness or conceptual mess up. And helpful almost to make a choice between the two, which I found took away attention. I found the tension between the two, notwithstanding what you said, is that you can just have pure awareness sort of in the background, like a computer program just chugging along.
I wouldn't quite use that description.
You mentioned the two could coexist. Because it was no conceptual elements, therefore there was nothing to get in the way. It's not been my dialectic experience.
No, well, I'm really pleased about that. Because I don't think it's a good idea to mix the two up. I mean, I think it's, you know, this... this practice is very much a heart commit, is a commitment. It's not an object. It's something that you put in place. And really, if that is your major focus, if that's what inspires you, I would really recommend that you stay with that. Because not everybody feels that way. People need things. If you feel that you can just... It is commitment. It's that commitment. This is to me is what going for refuge is. Never mind all the concepts and the ideas about becoming this and becoming that. Going for refuge to me is commitment to open up to yourself, to take refuge into that which is beyond me. And if you feel that inclination within you, if you feel that it works for you, then stick with it. You can get difficulties. We do get bottlenecks, log jams that will come along. What I'm saying is that if you do have knowledge of something that could possibly help you with that log jam, if you can't sit with the log jam and wait for it to free itself, which hopefully you can, do your very, very, very best to just sit with it and don't start fiddling with it. But if ultimately it's something that is genuinely too big for you, and we will find those things, then I'd see nothing wrong with just turning to help. And as soon as the logs begin to free up, then drop it. Don't get caught by it. Don't get caught up in it. That to me would be the relationship between the two. See the conceptual thing as something useful, as a skillful thing to use as and when, and only as and when, and then let it go. Let it go. This is just something that, you need a screwdriver because the door handle's fallen off. You don't walk around with the screwdriver in your hand, forever. You pick the screwdriver up, you put the handle back on, and then you put the screwdriver down. And that's what you do. That to me is the spirit of it. If you're coming the other way, well, I've never actually come that way, so but if you come the other way and you just concern yourself with the conceptual thing and you put all those ideas in place, this incredibly quite a intricate sort of visual, conceptual, emotional thing in place, I just say that you've got to be very careful. Like I say, you get stuck with it. But if you use it, I'm sure that if that's cultivated in the true spirit, in the true way, with that openness, as you were saying, that you're not grabbing hold of it and making it like this and like this, you will begin to discover that spaciousness. And the more you begin to awaken to it and open to it, the more you begin to see, well, this spaciousness is actually allowing me so much more access to this sort of meditation. So you don't really see the difference between the two. You see it as a way of helping you. It's all about getting attached, grabbing hold of things and holding on to things. But if you feel that you have that inclination where you really, it inspires you, where you really think, wow, this is really on the money, this one, and you really want to aspire to this type of practice, then go straight to it and stay with it. But do it in the context of a sangha. Because we're never going to go beyond this, and hopefully, a teacher. So, and this type of practice, because it's non-conceptual, and you don't have reference points. That's the thing with this. You don't have the reference points like you have with the conceptual thing. It does. You do need to be able to get guidance more, because reference points can often clear things for you. But when you don't have any, you've got no orientation, as it were. I'm lost. What can I grab hold of? And there's nothing to grab hold of. That's when you need, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha are not options in this. They're not options. And that needs to be in place. And that will help to support you and encourage you and inspire you and all the rest of it. All those human, those needs that all of us humans need to help us to walk this path.
David, can I ask you your advice on trying to detach from blame? Like, I feel like
blame, was that like guilt, you mean? Is that the same sort of thing?
Pass it on,
to blame somebody for something that's happened.
Or a situation would be, anything.
The only thing that you could say is to nurture your awareness and see what you're doing. Awareness, you awaken to what you do in your habits, and you can see how destructive they are and how negative, and which you may not have noticed before because obviously it was their fault. There's nothing to think about, is there? Now you begin to, you should stop from it and say, well, hang on, is it really their fault? Or, okay, maybe their fault, but is there not a bit of me in there? Am I not helping to create this situation? And that's the growing awareness, like Keane was saying in the beginning. You just become aware of what's unskillful in your life, and you see how destructive, and you learn to declutch from that. And there is nothing that... It's the commitment that allows you, because you want to do this practice, when you're going to fall into that old thing of blaming somebody else, you have that awareness and you just stop yourself. And it depends what it is. And if it's with somebody sort of important in your life and it's a part of your relationship, there's obviously a lot of emotion there. And you just not buy into that old way of reacting. And you're going to get that emotional, that's going to be incredibly frustrating. And it's going to give you a real thump. Well, with awareness and with a commitment to this, you can support that. And that's a fire. They're all fires. Guilt is no different than blame, than jealousy, than envy, than greed, and da-di-da. These are all pictures. We've all got different pictures, but it all fundamentally comes down. If you blow the pictures away, it all comes down. It's all driven by that emotion. That's underneath the picture. Actually, the more you can see the irrelevance of pictures and situations and actually just see the basic phenomenon that's in play there, you get much less likely to be caught up in different things and give values to different things. Just see that it's that volition that's underneath all of that that actually gives these things life, brings them into life and creates that reactivity and that karma, and on it goes. You can't really itemize the bits and pieces because it's just one basic fundamental principle that you learn to take to everything. And if you can take that principle to everything, again, it becomes so much simpler. There isn't different values and different pigeonholes that you've got to refer to and different manuals and different chapters. And it's all one. And it's born of awareness. It's born of that just knowing. That knowing, that emptiness that sits behind all of those situations, call it what you like. Some people might call it God.
I blame him once.
You what?
I blame him once.
God? It's a him,
why
is it?
Why are you making me suffer?
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's a perfectly human, perfectly okay. And I'm sure you won't take it personally. But just bring that principle to the whole of your life, and don't think. I mean, that may be something particularly strong with you, particularly big with you, and other things aren't quite so big. But don't start giving value. Just have that spirit of bringing yourself to all situations. And just learning to declutch from them and learning to just stay with whatever that habitual reaction may be. And as I say, just imagine it to be a fire. Just don't put fuel on it. Leave it alone. It's okay. The fire is absolutely fine. That fire is your best friend. That fire is the Buddha. And we must not get into a negative relationship. If we do, we're just fueling it. We're just putting more bits of wood on the fire.
You said that in this practice there's no samples?
No. Not officially.
I often get the feeling that it's almost like wandering blindly across the field, and I've kind of got sort of your teaching saying go that way, but because I can't see a thing, I can't tell whether I'm heading east or west.
Right.
How do I know I'm going in the right direction?
Right. That's what.
You just keep wondering.
You make sure that you have Buddha Dhamma Sangha in your life.
Yeah.
And if you think you can do it without Buddha Dhamma Sangha, you will wander around lost.
Yeah.
I guarantee it. I won't promise it, I will guarantee it. Mm. Have Buddha Dhamma Sangha in your life, and that will help to support you and to guide you and to orientate you and give you that confidence and that inspiration and that wish to carry on and to keep going. But you've got to have those in your life. I mean, I know, when I really consider the one teacher that I've had, which is when I first started, and I was wandering in the field completely blind. I didn't know what day of the week it was. Really, I was emotionally, it was just darkness. It was like walking around out there in the dark. And I didn't have a torch, just wandering around. And if I never had a teacher to support me and to give me encouragement, I would have fallen in the loch. No question, absolutely no question. But I was fortunate enough to have somebody who I trusted. And it's like, you know, they can take you, they can hold your hand. They can't walk for you, but they can hold your hand. And when your hand is held, you feel as though you can sort of hang on, as it were, and keep going. Buddha Dhamma Sangha is not an option. This is a Western thing, you see. I mean, this has never been we wouldn't have this conversation in the East for thousands of years. It's when it's come over, oh, I don't need all this. I understand Buddhism, I understand practice, look at it, think I'm stupid, look. I don't need that coming from all these silly people, I just want to, you know, I just get on with my own life, I know what to do. Yeah. Oh, you know, that's good luck, mate. That's all I can say. If you think anything of any value is going to change in you, then you're deeply deluded and deeply ignorant and deeply conceited. Not to have the humility to open up to what the wise have been telling us for thousands of years, and to follow what they suggest and how they say that this whole thing works. We need Buddha Dhamma Sangha, but not in a conceptual way, but in a heartfelt way. And there's a big difference, a huge difference.
And does that
It doesn't matter if you were sitting next to the Buddha. If you were practicing openly, genuine, sincerely, you will feel lost on a lot of occasions. You will feel very lonely and feel very wretched and feel and experience that darkness. Even if the Buddha was there holding your hand, that's inevitable, because that's in all of us. We've all got the dark side. But the value of that structure is that it helps to support us. But only you can do it. If you don't have that willingness to come to that and to stay with that. You know, when we get fear and when we get that sense of loneliness that is just so appalling, it's awful, and it's almost unbearable. For most of us, it is unbearable, and we've got to fill it in. Where's my diary? What am I doing? Fill my diary up every day for the next 3 months. I must not be with myself. Otherwise, I'm going to get lonely, and so I just fill my life with people and activities and activities. Everything to avoid me, to avoid myself. That loneliness, we sooner or later, we've got to face up to. And if it comes to our life, rather than try to react and fill it up, open up to it. But it needs to be you must feel as though, you know, we're gregarious species. We're not creatures, lonely creatures. We need each other. This is our nature. And to have that sense that you have people around you that are going through the same thing, that are in the same sort of headspace, like-minded people, is an enormous comfort, is an enormous help. It helps you bear with it and open up to yourself. And if you think you can do without all of those things, when you really come up to something like that, that loneliness that we all touch on, when it really hits you, boy, that I'll knock you for six. And you'll run. And when we run, we avoid the truth, we avoid what we are. And this thing doesn't work.
David, can you tell us more about Sangha? What do you mean by Sangha?
It means to be with like-minded people.
That's it.
I'm not concerned about like the form and the formality and you know, my Sangha's better than your Sangha.
Yes. It's
it's about being with people you feel comfortable with, people like-minded people who you feel that you can get that support, and if you and also what I mean is not only the support, but also, you know, when you're with like-minded people, they can also test you, because you can get into this thing, I understand this and I know that and I'm wise and I've cracked this one and I've cracked that one. Somebody can come, your friend can come along, sit next to you and say, well, you sure about that? Should we talk about that? And then, you know, you get challenged, which is always a good thing to happen, because if you ever say to yourself, this is it, you'd be very, very suspicious of that. This is it, I cracked it. You'd be very suspicious of that. But that's what we do. And Sangha, I mean, this to me, this here now, you know, most of us don't know each other. You know, we're all struggling with names. We've hardly spoken to each other. You know, tomorrow we're all going to go to the different parts of the world. May never even see each other again. And this is not an official FWBO event, so you can't even say we're an FWBO Sangha. But to me, this is Sangha. This is really, this is the absolute sharp end. This is, to me, was what Sangha is about. And Sangha is about getting support so that you can open up to yourself. And truly open up to yourself, feeling that you've got a framework around you that's actually helping you to, like, as it were, to take that step, that extra step that you could never ever do when you're on your own. You can't do it. But to create a framework where you feel you can trust that you can open and you can let go like you've never let go before, and just allow yourself, is like falling off the cliff. It's just allowing yourself to fall, to go beyond. This is only going to be possible when a form and a structure like this is put in place with people, not objects, but other human beings who are aspiring to the same fulfillment. This is Sangha. I don't care less what label you want to put on it, whether it's FWBO or, you know, we're all on sitting on Tibetan cushions. I suppose that might be a bit Tibetan, I suppose. To me, that's irrelevant. Those are just labels and just, you know, things that we get attached to. It's that, to me, this is Sangha. This is real Sangha. And if we can replicate things like this on a regular basis, this is the support that we'll get from that aspect, so that we can truly open up to ourselves and, metaphorically speaking, go where we've never gone before. And that allows us to do that. I mean, I think back, and I can, I go into tears, actually. And when I go back to my Zen days, when I used to sit in a Zendo, a bit bigger than this, I suppose, about 36 people in there. And the stuff that I went through in that, you know, when you go in the Zendo, it's not like here, I can assure you. When you go in the Zendo, there's no compromise. You go in there and you sit and you don't move. And that's it. There are no options. You just go in and you do it. And, you know, it's something that might frighten you and you might recoil away from. But actually, it's a wonderfully skillful way of practice. And I've been in that. I've been in company, like on Sesshin or just on weekend stuff, where I have gone through, you know, physically and emotionally, really incredible. incredibly difficult times, and I've looked around the room with gratitude that if these people weren't here helping me, I wouldn't be able to do this. I could never do it. This is not the teacher. This is just the fellow practitioners sitting in the room. And I've known that. This is why I try to replicate it to some extent. This, whenever I do these, if I'm here in 20 years' time and I come back and do one of these here in 20 years, it will be exactly as it is today. It will not change. Because I know that support is just so precious. It is so precious. It is so precious because it allows you to let go of yourself. And that's the value. To me, that's what Sangha is. It isn't about sitting around a table having cups of tea and chattering about, you know, what did you have for breakfast and, you know, all that sort of mundane stuff. I don't know what value that has, but in terms of really aspiring to the practice and to getting that support and that help. This, as I say, when I look back over my early years, I just so much gratitude to those people. I didn't even know where they are. I didn't even know half of them. I didn't know their names. I had no idea what they used to eat for breakfast. Somehow it wasn't important. I don't know why. I'm obviously missing something. Somehow I thought it wasn't really important. So I know the value of that. And you know, when I do this, I try to replicate my experience. I'm not just coming up with fancy ideas to be different or to, you know, test you or, you know, take you to the limit. So I'm just trying to replicate something that's worked very well for me. And I just offer it to others, to you. And it's here. And you can make use of this. You can really make use of this, or you can manipulate it. You can fiddle with it and sort of do it on your own terms. What good that is, why you want to come here and do that is beyond me. But, you know, that can happen. But to come here and to use the structure as has been offered, I think this is something very special. I really mean that. When I go on retreat with people and I put something like this in place, I really think that is very, very special. It is very, very special because you can go where you've never gone before. You can open up and let go like you've never done in your life. And that can change your life. And I think that's really special. But it's not going to be possible unless we all create it. I don't create this. I say, well, look, let's do it this way. Everybody has to play their part. And then when we all play our part, we can all take. We give and we take. That's the true Bodhisattva mentality, the true Bodhisattva spirit. It's not about just giving, as some people think.
It's
about
ground.
Giving, and it's about learning to give, and when we give, we can take from that. And that is, I think, is tremendous. I really think that's tremendous. So, we're going to have a very short meditation period. But it's quality, not quantity. So, yeah, that will do for today. Thank you.